That was kind of odd music you were listening to. Actually, it was part of your DNA, your guanine nucleotide, and that was from an album, Sequentia, by Susan Alexandra. That's Alexjander. I'm Sherry Edwards, your host for Sound Health on BBS Radio, and for the next hour, I'll be with you with Larry Trivieri. And both of us are delighted that you could join us for a bit of conversation designed to provide options and information for self-health. You know, that idea about self-health, that's a good idea. It means that you take responsibility for your own health, and that's what we're going to talk about on the show. The cut guanine from Susan and her album Sequentia. And Susan, by the way, is one of those very talented ladies, talented musically, and she's one of the real, genuine people on the planet. But she designed this album and made all the musical arrangements and actually has put your DNA into music, because everything that happens in your body is by way of frequency, and every healing that takes place is really just about changing or moving around, manipulating, supporting those frequencies. I put Susan's stuff on our information about the radio show. You can also find her on oursounduniverse.com or xjander, X-J-A-N-D-E-R, at gotgot.net. And I think it's very appropriate for tonight's show that we use guanine, because in the vocal prints that we've been doing recently in our research project about allergies, we're finding that wheat causes a lot of people not to be able to use their guanine appropriately. And it's something that they're doing, I guess, to process the wheat that's causing this. This goes right along with something that Larry Trivieri, who's our guest tonight, said last week, that people in the know, or in control, really, create a problem, and then they create a solution to it. And in this case, our food supply is being adulterated to the point that it's causing us allergies, and then the drug companies are selling us all these pills for all these allergies. And we're finding in what we're doing that this is causing arthritis, fibromyalgia, thyroid issues, cholesterol issues. So we're going to go on with our second in the series about who and what we can trust. Now, last week we mentioned the media, big pharma, legal system, bird flu. There's a lot of you who've called and added a lot of information to that, things we didn't think about. Schools, gas prices, war. No one seems to trust the war. One lady wrote in to say, documentaries are now just commercials. And commercials used to be to notify us of new products and tell us all about, you know, all the good things that were happening and people were bringing to us to make our life easier. And now they just seem to be commercials that make you feel inadequate if you don't buy a product. So that's another thing, you know, create a problem and then run in and try to save everybody. You know, one of the things that I found odd about the people who were calling in and telling us who they trust, pharmacists rated the highest. You know, it used to be people like Walter Cronkite, but it was pharmacists. I guess if the drug companies are going to put things out, we need to trust the pharmacists to tell us what's really going on. In our paper today, there was an article about, I think it was Vioxx, and they had, whatever that company is, Pfizer, I think, had over 1,000 legal battles they were fighting against people who had gotten hurt with that. And I wonder how that happened, how that got through. What's in the system that allows a medication to get through that's ending up hurting thousands of people? So we're going to be talking to Larry, and he's a health advocate who names names. He's tough and decisive, and he's going to help us understand how we're being hoodwinked by our government, the pharmaceutical companies, the AMA, Larry not only delivers the facts, but attempts to help us find solutions to the disaster that we call healthcare system. So we'll be with Larry in a few minutes, right after a couple really short announcements. One, our format again, we're going to use email for questions for our guests, although I did listen to the show right before this, Dawn, and the phones were great and you could hear. But if you want to write to us, it's soundhealth@soundhealth.org, and I will be monitoring that email. If you have something really urgent, I don't know if Don's going to agree with this, but you could call him at the new toll-free number, 877-876-5227. And if we can't hear you on the phone, he will probably be glad to relay a message to us. As I said last week, and I want to say it again, the new scheduling, the new format on BBS and Who's On Now looks great. And if any of you want the information about how to get in touch with Larry Trivieri or Susan Alexandra, I've posted that for you. Robbie was on the show right before this, and he was talking to a caller named Sheila. And he said she could tell that she was a mommy. He said he could tell she was a mommy because her voice said that she was a nurturer. And I thought some of you might be interested to know that that's because she has a lot of low harmonics in her voice. And we can tell a lot about voice when people are lying. We can even tell, like, things about what the name of your name means, the name of a place means. And since the telephone is getting better, the telephone connection for the show, then we might go back to doing some of your signature sounds on the air. So get in touch with us and let us know what you want to hear. Okay, we need to catch up a bit from last week. We got an avalanche of email about the show that Larry Trivieri and Ralph Fusitola did. They had a great conversation going on about our health rights. Larry was incredibly knowledgeable about what is going on in the healthcare world. I think we let you know that he's an author. That big silver book that you probably find in all the doctor's offices about alternative medicine, he helped edit that. He did the American Holistic Healing in the New Millennium. He's done a holistic guide to holistic health. He's co-authored the Complete Self-Care Guide to Holistic Medicine. He wrote Health on the Edge. Larry, I've probably butchered a lot of what you wrote, so you can correct those titles. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sherry. It's my pleasure.
It was so great, this conversation you and Ralph were thrown about last week about how we are, our health is mandated from the top down by the government, HMOs, or insurance companies. As I'm going to ask you to recap a little bit about what you and Ralph talked about, but I'd like to hear a bit more about what you were talking about last week, and really, how did that happen? How did we, the people, let that happen? So first, can you kind of recap what you talked about with Ralph and what you told us about the history of the AMA and how we got in this pickle in the first place?
Well, the very short version is that for actually since the middle of the 1800s in this country, there's been a concerted effort to keep healthcare and medicine under the province of a very limited philosophy, which is primarily symptom care, not healing, and certainly not healing on the deep levels, which people like you are doing when you're working with frequencies and energy and things of that nature, which also can create shifts in consciousness, shifts in emotional baselines and things of that nature. So what they've done, particularly when the petrochemicals started to have a role in our drugs, such as penicillin and things of that nature in the early parts of the 20th century, is they saw an opportunity to make extremely large profits, and the way that they went about doing that was taking control of the medical system, and that began by taking control over the curriculum of most of the healthcare medical schools in this country, which was done primarily by under the guise of philanthropy, and so these philanthropic foundations such as the Rockefeller Foundation would go into these medical schools and say, look, we want to make sure that there's a minimum standard of excellence in your training, and in order to do that we recognize that you need a lot of money to create these changes that the public is clamoring for. And this all occurred, again, going back to last week's show, in the very first decade of the 20th century. And so what happened was a lot of these colleges said, okay, fine, we'll take the money, and the money is given in perpetuity, so every year they get grants and things of that nature. And the only request that they made, these funders, to the colleges was that they wanted control, complete control of their curriculum. So literally overnight, what happened was you had a curriculum that used to cover diet, nutrition, body work, homeopathy, herbs, chiropractic, osteopathic medicine, naturopathic medicine, some of the more quote-unquote esoteric systems of healing such as magnetic therapies and things of that nature. That was all replaced overnight, and the medical curriculum then became symptom care using primarily drugs and then surgery. And so doctors started to only be educated in that very limited spectrum. So it's not really the doctor's fault that he or she is not aware of a lot of these alternatives that are far more powerful, far more effective than drugs and surgery tend to be, particularly for chronic illness. I want to emphasize drugs and surgery both have their place, obviously, in certain instances, particularly acute threatening health conditions. For instance, if someone was in a major car accident, I certainly wouldn't send them to an energy healer first and foremost. I'd send them to a trauma center where they could make sure that their organs are okay and everything else. And then later on, when they're stabilized, the energy healer might be able to come in and things of that nature. But things have a place. But what happened was everything that wasn't, quote-unquote, conventional medicine got thrown out the window. And then once that occurred, a lot of money went in play in order to make sure that it stayed that way. So the AMA started to receive tremendous endowments from the Rockefeller Foundation and other foundations and pharmaceutical companies and things of that nature. Now, there's an interesting fact about John D. Rockefeller. I may have mentioned this last week. I don't recall if I did or not. But he lived to be in his 90s, and he was a very healthy man for most of his life. His primary physician was the same physician of the royal family in England, and that physician was an homeopath, and he was paid a lot of money by Rockefeller to keep his mouth shut and not say that he was treating Rockefeller. So Rockefeller's first choice for his own health care was an alternative physician. Now, homeopathic physicians have been widely accepted by the royal families in England for many, many decades. And I found this out when I was compiling the book Alternative Medicine Definitive Guide. That's the big gray book you were talking about with Burton Goldberg. And one of the contributors for the book was a man named Trevor Cook. And Trevor Cook is a brilliant homeopathic physician who succeeded Rockefeller's physician. Actually, I think there was another homeopath in between the two of them, but Trevor Cook at one point was also the physician for the royal family, and he shared this information. So here you have the hypocrisy of the world's wealthiest man privately receiving alternative health care and from a therapy that is considered by conventional medicines to be baseless. In other words, they constantly say that homeopathic remedies cannot possibly work because the remedies themselves don't contain, on a physical level, they don't contain any aspect of the original ingredients. What they fail to recognize when they make that argument is the energetic frequency of the original elements are there and are far more powerful the more they're diluted out of the physical to the point where they're almost non-existent. That's true. But the energetic frequency becomes more and more powerful. And I don't want to make this a treatise on homeopathy because it's a very complicated subject. But when you take those remedies, They work on an energetic level, very, very powerfully, and if you are given the appropriate remedy by a competent homeopathic physician who's trained to do this, all sorts of things can occur in your body beyond just the relief of symptoms. You will often have an emotional shift. Sometimes people will heal long-standing griefs or other unresolved emotions. And it's basically because these remedies are able to impact the energy field that surrounds the physical body as well as the physical body itself. And so they create shifts and balances of these frequencies that we are all made of. And once you bring, as Sherry and the work that she's done proves, once you bring these frequencies into balance, tremendous shifts happen, not only on the physical level, but also on the emotional level, the mental level, and shifts of awareness and consciousness. So getting, not to go too off topic, so what happened was then the pharmaceutical companies pretty much had their monopoly, and that monopoly ran pretty much unimpeded for most of the 20th century. What happened in the 60s and 70s is that people started to become dissatisfied with just drugs and surgery as their only healthcare option. So they started to look beyond that. And around that same time, people such as Dr. Linus Pauling, who's won 2 Nobel Prizes and was in as early as the 1950s, a tremendous proponent of the value of vitamin C, this stuff started to get into the media and people started to hear about it, and out of curiosity they started to take vitamins more regularly than perhaps their parents' generation did. But at the same time, Pauling, who, as I said, won the Nobel Prize twice and was one of the most brilliant men to ever live in the 20th century, he was branded a quack for his claims about vitamin C.
And they tried to do it after he died, which I thought was very much cowardly.
Absolutely. Well, he faced criticism through most of the latter part of his life for his views about healing. But there is when you talk about vitamin C alone, there are literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of studies that document and validate everything that he said. And what they also point out is that the need for vitamin C in the human body is far greater than what conventional doctors will tell you. And we have something that it's called the RDA, the recommended daily allowance for nutrients. And the recommended daily allowance is 60 milligrams for vitamin C. And as Ralph mentioned last week, that's the amount of vitamin C that the body needs not to develop scurvy. But it's not the amount of vitamin C that the body needs to maintain optimal health. What Pauling found is that in a state of no disease, no obvious disease symptoms, a person may need actually 3 to 6 to even 12,000 milligrams on a daily basis. Pauling himself took 18,000 milligrams a day when he wasn't sick, and he would take that in divided doses, 6,000 milligrams 3 times a day. This is something he shared with me a year before he died. And he told me if he felt the slightest onset of a cold or a flu or something like that, he would up the dose dramatically and prevent himself from getting the cold or the flu. But everyone has what's called biochemical individuality, just as in the work that you do, Sherry, everyone has a unique signature sound. So you can't say, and I'm not saying, that each person should be taking 18,000 milligrams of vitamin C. It needs to be in harmony with your specific needs based on your genes and biochemical predisposition. But I can say with certainty that everybody needs more than 60 milligrams of vitamin C.
Can I interject something?
Sure.
One, people ought to know that the human body doesn't make its own vitamin C.
Right.
We have to get it from outside sources. And two, I've heard a lot of people complain that too much C causes them kidney pain. And that's an indicator from testing we've done that they aren't taking enough magnesium with it to make the body use it. It's just being sloughed off as a byproduct.
Well, that's an important point, because no nutrient really works in a vacuum. The best way to get all the nutrition we need is through our diet. Unfortunately, the the levels of minerals in the soil are so depleted because of modern farming methods, as this goes way back to the beginning of the 20th century as well. Commercial farming methods depleted and eroded the minerals from the soil. Well, the minerals are the essential elements in soil that provide the nutrients and the fruits and vegetables that farmers grow. And so if you have depleted minerals in your soil, you are growing depleted, even if you're growing them using organic methods, you're growing depleted, or you're growing produce that has depleted nutrient content compared to the nutrient content of those same fruits and vegetables going back a few hundred years ago when things were more pristine and there wasn't all these environmental pollutants and things of that nature. Compounding that is the fact that then these foods are harvested and they're shipped across the country, across, you know, from nation to nation, and by the time you actually get them, whatever nutrient content is there is even further depleted. So it's almost impossible at this point in time for anybody, no matter how healthy their diet is, no matter how organic their diet is, to get all of the nutrients that they need. Not only that, on a daily basis, our nutrient needs shift as well, depending on such factors such as stress. If you're under emotional or physical stress, your requirements for certain nutrients go up. But nature designed everything, God designed everything in a wonderful way, because everything works synergistically. So you get the nutrients, which you'd get vitamins, minerals, coenzymes, and enzymes, and all these things, essential fatty acids, and they would all work together within the fruit and the vegetable. What people who are studying nutritional supplements are finding out is that it's always best to have a balanced multi-mineral vitamin formula as a base, and then you might supplement with additional vitamin C, for instance, or things of that nature on top of that. But if you're taking the multi-mineral, multivitamin, then you're at least providing your body with a certain level, at least, of the various nutrients that your body needs.
A lot of our food is picked green, number one, so it doesn't even have the ready or available nutrients. And they artificially, they gas these foods and artificially make them ripe. We're finding an absolute epidemic of people who don't have enough minerals and can't use their minerals. And we've done a project that might help people, that fatty acids seem to come first, and then vitamin D. And in this case, it's dry vitamin D, like some dark leafy green vegetables. That, in turn, makes your minerals work. That's your thyroid, so your whole energy system of the body. Those minerals make vitamins work, and vitamins make enzymes. So it's an entire package, and each ripened, sun-ripened piece of fruit has that everything in it that it needs to digest itself. So when you eat it, it shouldn't cause some kind of allergies. And one of the things people were talking about that they don't trust, absolutely, is our food supply. So this is great stuff here. I want to jump back to something that might help people understand homeopathy a bit. And the studies that we've done over the last 15 years, people who do very, very well on homeopathy are right-brained people. And that's only going to get about 40% of the population. And it's like people who use color and sound together, they have to consider brain dominance. And I think with homeopathy, when you look at who stays with it and who gets along with it very well, when we test them, a lot of them are right brain. Is there a chance you can talk to some of the wonderful homeopathic people you know and let's suggest that and see what kind of yin-yang, left-right, positive-negative kinds of things that could be done with homeopathy to make it more potent for the left brain people?
That's a possibility. What you're sharing right now is news to me, and it's exciting news. At the other hand, too, though, there are a lot of things that have happened in the field of alternative medicine. I wanted to discuss this as well tonight, because we didn't have a chance to talk about it last week. what happened was, to complete the history, was in the 60s and 70s, you started to have an interest in more and more alternative, quote-unquote, alternative healing methods. And by the time the 90s rolled around, there was a study conducted by Harvard researchers that showed that 34% of all Americans were choosing some sort of alternative health care to meet their health care needs. And today, the statistics show that that number is actually closer to 70%. What happened in tandem with that is that the market for these types of supplements and homeopathic remedies and things of that nature grew far more significantly than they had grown in previous decades. So what happened was the control cartels, as I like to call them, particularly the pharmaceutical industry, looked at this and said, well, you know, we need to start reining this in because it's cutting into our profits, even though they're the one of the most profitable industries in the entire world. So what you're seeing now in the media is a lot of stories that are literally planted by pharmaceutical ad agencies, you might say, ad agencies that the pharmaceutical companies hire or press PR people. And so you're seeing a lot, particularly in the last couple of years, almost every day you can find, if you look for it, if you search the media, articles that are pretty much saying nutrients don't work, nutrients are dangerous, this, that, and the other thing. But if you actually investigate those stories and the so-called scientific studies that the stories are based on, you see that the studies are flawed, and they're flawed consistently. So the question that I have when a pattern like this exists is, how can it be that competent scientists are consistently creating flawed double-blind studies? Well, they're not doing it by mistake. They're literally creating parameters where they're going to get the results that they want. And then, of course, as soon as they get those results, they trumpet them across the media as another indication that this doesn't work or that doesn't work. And compounding that, and I mentioned this last week, is that the people in the media that report these stories are not trained as scientists or physicians, so they typically will take this stuff at face value and run with it. Further compounding the problem is what one of your readers wrote in, Sherry, is that a lot of the news that we're getting today, particularly on the television news, are literally documentaries that are made by special interest groups and filmed in a way that it seems like it's actual reporting that's taking place, when really it's all done in a studio with a specific agenda, and they put it out there. Even our White House has done this. The General Accounting Office has rebuked them for doing this, but so far I've gotten away with it because the public doesn't seem to care, and Congress certainly doesn't seem to care. And so a lot of these news stories that are coming about specific agendas that the White House has are literally being created by ad agencies and paid for by taxpayer dollars and put on the evening news as fact, when in fact they're nothing more than PR. And so what they do is, Noam Chomsky, a very brilliant writer and researcher, not a physician, he's not in the field of health, but he wrote a book years ago called Manufacturing Consent. And this is one of the ways that they do it. They manufacture the public's consent. One of the most brilliant campaigns ever conducted that shows how this is done is what occurred in the build-up to the current Iraqi invasion, which, from my perspective, is illegal, immoral, and criminal. And there's a wonderful book about how this was all done that your readers or your listeners can find on Google. The title of the book is called Weapons of Mass Deception. And it documents literally over and over and over again how the Bush administration, the Saudi government, the Kuwaiti government, all these other players that are involved in the Middle East conflict have used major, major PR media organizations to plant stories in the news that are completely false, in order to get the reaction that they want from the public so that the public will support the aims that they have. And that's exactly what happened in terms of how we got in this current conflict that we're in with Iraq, which by all accounts, except for the White House, is a failure. And moreover, as I said earlier, in my opinion, it's criminal because it did not respect the sovereignty of another nation. And we now know, it's without a doubt, that there were never any weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. There was never going to be the threat of a nuclear mushroom cloud, as Condoleezza Rice so graphically said in a news conference once, and things of that nature. Moreover, people need to understand that words themselves are powerful and are often used to manipulate. We often hear the word or the phrase, weapons of mass destruction, for instance. Well, which nation on earth has the most weapons of mass destruction? The United States.
Yeah.
We're the only nation to have ever employed nuclear warfare on another nation. We did this, obviously, at the end of World War II in Japan. So, you know, it's like the kettle calling another country black when we're doing this. And now there's this big debate as to whether or not Iran should have nuclear weapons. And the Iranians are saying, look, we're not manufacturing nuclear weapons. We want to manufacture nuclear energy. Now, they may be lying, and the potential that they're lying is probably pretty high. But at the same time, as a people that has the largest arsenal of nuclear weapons in the world and the only nation to ever use them, what right do we have to tell another country they can't do the same thing? These are the types of moral hypocrisy that are taking place, not only in the field of health. It's all tied in. And until the public stops being passive, we're going to discuss, and I hope we get into it, Sherry, how people can liberate themselves from all of these things. Well, the first and foremost thing that has to be done is each person on an individual basis has to stop being passive and has to become proactive. And bringing this back to health, if they want to ensure that they're healthy, despite everything that we've talking about, these controlling interests that regulate our health care and interfere with our food supply and all these other things, despite all of that, it's still extremely possible to be vibrantly healthy. I know many, many people that are vibrantly healthy and are not affected in the least by any of these things on a personal level, simply because they've taken responsibility for their health and they don't make excuses. And they find physicians, if they need to work with physicians, they find physicians that are informed enough to give them the care and the treatment that they're looking for. And if those physicians are incapable of doing that, they, in a sense, fire them. They no longer go to them, and they keep searching. They find something that works. Once they find something that works, then they make that part of their daily and regular routine. So self-responsibility is the first and foremost thing that is necessary for people to take if they want to talk about being healthy. You have to walk your talk. You can't just talk about it. And the problem is, Sherry, is we as a nation, particularly I feel the United Nations, the United States, is the most complacent nation in that regard, because we are now so used to having a magic pill for everything. You know, we have people that know they're not exercising, that know that they're eating poorly, that know that they're engaging in unhealthy lifestyle regimens, and they don't want to take responsibility for anything, and yet when they have these symptoms, they run to a doctor and say, give me a pill to make me better, and when the medicine doesn't work, they blame the doctor. They need to start pointing the finger at themselves. And we all of us need to do this, because I think at this point in time, we as a planet are going into a very accelerated phase, and it seems to me that the planet itself is literally crying out to us and saying, grow or die. And I've felt that inwardly for a number of years now. I really feel that the lifestyle that we have, that's the unconscious, selfish, passive lifestyle, is no longer going to serve us on a planetary level, and the planet itself is going to get rid of those people who don't want to take that next step in consciousness. And that may sound harsh, but I don't believe it is, because on another level, none of us die. We're all immortal beings, at least. That's more than my belief. That's my experience, and anyone else can prove that for themselves if they so choose. So, you know, whether people pass away or not physically is, to me, it can be sad, but it's not necessarily the end of the story. But self-responsibility is the key for all the problems that we're talking about. And then, once you start to do this individually, you start to create a dynamic where major, major, major shifts can occur on a societal level. For instance, one of the things that people don't know about our own history is that during the entire 8 years that the Revolutionary War was being fought, only about 3% of the American population actually supported it.
Good grief.
That's an absolute fact.
We got an email from a lady named Kathy who told us that there was a march last week on Washington that was anti-war, 250,000 people, and that was just their local news. There wasn't a thing about it on our news here, so we're not even getting any news about who's having a problem except the internet or who's
right.
marching. 3%?
3%. Now, it's interesting. Why was that? Everyone thinks, you know, that the King George was a very despotic ruler and everything else. In actual fact, the colonists, the English colonists here in America, had it very well under King George. And the so-called Boston Tea Party that protested taxes, you know what the tax was? It was 1% of their income. Imagine how many people would jump through a barrel if they only had to pay 1% of their income today.
Yes.
They were, by and large, there was a very strong merchant class here in the 13 colonies that benefited. They had the protection of the British Army. They had a market for their goods outside of the colonies to go back to England. All these wonderful economic stable things. The one thing they didn't have was freedom. And enough people, but still a very small percent, starting with our founding fathers, recognized that and decided it was time to put an end to it. And yet, during the course of the war, particularly in the first year, 97% of the population was against it.
Are you saying this for or against the Iraq War?
97% of the colonists were supporters of the crown. They were not supporters of what the founding fathers were trying to do. And they certainly, I mean, Washington, if you study, it's a tremendous, tremendous testament to the will and the dedication of these people. Because if people would take the time to study what happened to the original signers of the Declaration of Independence, and everyone knows about Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson and George Washington became presidents and things of that nature. But most of these people were killed, they were hung, or their economic welfare was destroyed, or their families were killed. There was tremendous suffering. Very few of the original founders actually survived the conflict or were better off after the war was fought and America achieved its independence. So they literally sacrificed their lives, the lives of their loved ones in some cases, and their economic well-being to bring freedom to a continent. Now, I'm raising that point because I said earlier 70% of the population is choosing some form of alternative medicine for their health care. Well, imagine what would happen if that 70% of the population just decided to band together and say, enough is enough, we want to stop this. These cartels. We want to get their influence out of the Senate. We want to get it out of the Food and Drug Administration, which on the administrative level has basically become a rubber stamp for the pharmaceutical industry. All of these things could change overnight if the American people demanded it.
How do we
but
do that?
But most people believe that they can't do anything about it. They're passive and that they're conditioned to believe, well, that's just the way it is and you can't fight City Hall. Well, you actually can. But as I said, the first step is to create the freedom you want and the health you want in your own life individually. And that's a lot easier to do than it is to topple a system.
Who and what is out there that we can trust to start doing that? You get bombarded by all of these multi-level vitamins and ads about this one's best and eat this food.
Yeah, well,
where do you start?
You start with yourself, Sherry. We need to start to trust our own power and our own intuition because we all have it. Each of us is a very powerful person, and each of us if we allow ourselves to trust ourselves, has a knowingness about whether something is right or wrong.
About the food we eat?
About everything.
If you pick up a tomato and it doesn't speak to you, don't buy it?
Exactly. But you're talking about living life at a very conscious level, and that's something that most of us, to be frank, even myself a lot of times, don't want to do. It's work and it's responsibility, and we'd rather just go with the flow. I'll be the first to admit I am not a paragon of health or virtue. There are plenty of times when, you know, I'll just go the easy route and I'll, you know, genetically I'm predisposed to be very healthy. My grandfathers, both of my grandfather and grandmothers lived very long, and my parents are still alive. So I've never really had any health issues of any consequence. You know, I mentioned the kidney stone and bronchitis, but they weren't serious last week. And so there'll be times where I'll skip a meal when I know I shouldn't skip a meal, or I'll have a sub from a takeout place when I know I shouldn't have the sub at the takeout place, or I'll eat wheat when I know that, as you mentioned, a lot of people are allergic to wheat, and I happen to be, I'm not overtly allergic, but I know that I have a sensitivity to it and I should avoid it. So there are times too when I'm lazy, but when I am on my game, as it were, and honoring myself and valuing myself, I don't make those choices. I don't make those unhealthy choices. I make the healthy choices. And it's really a game to me that plays itself out on a level of consciousness, because the more I love and accept and trust myself, the less I find myself doing these things that are unhealthy. Whereas if I get into a kind of an unconscious state, kind of sleepwalking through the day, as it were, as most of us do from time to time, then it's easier to just fall into these unhealthy patterns. So it's a diligent process. We have to constantly watch ourselves in a way with love and affection and humor, because we're going to slip up. All of us are going to slip up. And when you do, you just get up and you know, the Chinese have a phrase, fall down seven times, rise eight, and that's the path to victory. You just keep getting up. You keep learning from your mistakes, acknowledging mistakes, and then working on yourself to do better.
You have a wonderful philosophy about this. Are you doing a book about this? It's great stuff.
Well, I'm doing it in my personal life first. I don't want to write a book about something that I haven't really completely figured out yet. But this is obvious to me, and so I'm sharing it. And I never prepare anything, and this is just, you know, what I'm inwardly being guided to say right now, so I'm saying it. But going back to who do you trust, I can tell you, first of all, if you're looking for healthcare information in the major media, you're making a big mistake, because it's not there. Similarly, if you're looking for the truth about what's going on in the Bush administration, very little of it's in the media, in the mainstream media. There are definitely internet sites and alternative publications and radio shows such as this one where you can find the truth. But the first and foremost thing that you need to do, including all of you who are listening to me, don't just take what I'm saying at face value. See if it resonates within yourself.
Right.
And one of the simplest ways that I found, and I figured this out a long time ago, and then I kind of figured it out unconsciously, but I never articulated it. And then I actually, when I was writing Alternative Medicine, The Definitive Guide, I came across it written. It was written by someone in the field of mind-body medicine. And he'd written this little article about how you can tell if something is true or false. So I'll share this with you right now for your readers or listeners. I'm saying readers because I write books. But it's very simple. Say something to yourself that you know to be true. And as you say it, feel how it feels within your solar plexus. Then say something to yourself that you know to be a lie. And notice how that feels in your solar plexus. When you tell the truth, there's a certain expansive energy in the area of the belly. When you tell a lie, the belly energy, the solar plexus energy, becomes tense. And there's a certain discomfort. Now, it may not be an obvious tension like a stomach pain or something like that, But if you take time to notice your subtle energies and you explore this and you work with it, over time you're going to become very, very good at determining immediately whether or not you are telling the truth and whether or not the people that you interact with are telling you the truth, or whether you're lying or they're lying. Because the body does not lie. The body is the ultimate lie detector test. And when you tune into the body on that level, and it's very simple. It sounds perhaps crazy to some people, but it's very, very simple. To say, for instance, say your first name. My name is, and say your first name at the end of that sentence, and notice how you feel. Then say my name is, and say a name that's not your name. There will be a tremendous difference energetically in your solar plexus. And it becomes even more pronounced when the lies are very serious. So as you read or listen or watch people tell you about anything, just tune into your body from time to time and notice how it feels. Is it serving you? Do you feel happy? Do you feel joyous? Or do you feel tense? Do you feel upset? And there's a healthy upset. Like, for instance, when we're talking about these control groups and stuff and it's resonating as truth, people tend to get angry about it when they first understand it. And that there's nothing wrong with that. But that type of feeling in the solar plexus is not the same type of feeling that you'll have when you see someone telling you something that's a lie and is making you angry. There's a difference.
I want to tell a short story about lying. We worked with a company and ended up doing a computer program about telling how people lie or how you can tell it from their voice. And this computer program is only available to police and investigators and things like that, because they decided that if they released a computer program to anybody that could tell who was lying, there would be absolute chaos in the U.S. That's pretty awful. The other thing about energy, this is my pet peeve. I don't allow people to pray over my food. I want to pray over my food. I want to meditate with my food and make sure that the things are compatible and it's energized in a way that I know it's going to be good for me. So that's just one of the little things I do. But what we're talking about here, if we really look at it on a philosophical level, in the beginning there was God's law about how to interact. And then we got off track with lying and trying to be successful by being more powerful or whatever, and so we had to create all these man laws so we could get along with each other. And even those are being thrown out the window now, because I think we're living under the laws of economics. And that's what we've been talking about all evening. And it just dawned on me when we did a show a couple weeks ago, I think it was right before you came on, we asked people the question, how do you consider yourself successful? Money, your kids, how much property you own, how integral people feel you are. And most people, it was property and money and what other people perceive you to be, not what you really are from inside you. Very few people mentioned being authentic from the inside. That was their success. It was all outside stuff. So the spirituality of who you are and finding that place of peace within how you interact is the same kind of thing if you're going to interact with your food and interact with yourself in that same way. These are good steps. First, self-help, then look for truth, and then go inside. There's three big steps. Are there others that are obvious?
Well, what happens when people start to make a commitment to this type of living, and they start to have success with it, without them needing to do anything consciously beyond that, I find that people in their circle, whether it's family members, people at work, whatever, people they socialize with, having relationships with, whatever it is, if those people are no longer serving their truth, then those people will just naturally start to fall away. And it's not an acrimonious situation. It's usually not a conflict. You just find yourself suddenly no longer associating with people who are not committed to this journey we're talking about tonight. And in place of those people, you'll start to find yourself automatically attracting people who are. And in that attraction process, there's a vortex energy, I like to call it, that gets created. You know, and I think in the Bible they talk about the phrase, Jesus says, whenever two or more are gathered in my name, I am there. What he's referring to, from my perspective, is that when two or more like-minded people get together, you create a powerful energy that's greater than the sum of its parts. But that energy starts to attract itself as soon as you start to, as soon as each of us start to commit to our own truth and become authentic and follow our authentic inner impulses. My definition of success, Sherry, is basically this. I believe that every single person is born, regardless of what physical handicaps they might have or not, every single person is born with a unique gift that they have come into this world to share with the world, with God's creation. Most of us never give ourselves the opportunity to commit to sharing that gift because from the moment we're born, literally, our educational systems and things of that nature are teaching us that we need to focus on getting a job and making money and this, that, and the other thing, and we lose sight of what our gift is. And in losing sight of what our gift is, we also lose sight of what gives us the most enjoyment and the most joy and the most energy and the most passion. And guess what that is? It's our gift. We love our gift. And little children know this instinctively. And you can see if children are not raised in a fearful environment or overly restrictive environment, you'll see that children naturally grow according to their own interests and loves. They'll find activities that they're good at and that they love doing, and the more that they do that, the more they develop their overall skill set to go forward in life. What happens is they start to develop this, and then by the time they're 3 or 4 or 5, they're in preschool or school, and all of a sudden they're in a regimented situation where they're told they can't do the very things that they love because it's inappropriate now because they're in school and they need to sit still and they have to listen to some adult tell them this, 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 and this for 8 hours. And so this starts to get stultified, and they lose sight of it. Most children, they lose sight of it. But all of us, if we're honest with ourselves, can remember when we were younger what gave us joy. And then we say, well, I can't do this now because, you know, it's just impractical, or it's just that. In other words, we rationalize away our gift. But if you commit to that gift and you literally start to move with it, miraculous things happen. And my life is a case in point of this. I knew from the time I was well before school, I dropped out of nursery school. That's how bored I was with formal education. And I never completed college for the same reason. I basically always was educating myself according to my interest, and I was tremendously gifted academically. My classmates and friends were always envious of me because I was the guy that never studied and always got hundreds on tests throughout, you know, all of my formal education. But I was primarily bored with it. I was also the person that was skipping class to go to the school library and just devour books that weren't being taught in my class, and writing term papers as special projects simply because I loved it. But when I was very young, my mother awakened me to my love of writing and my love of reading. And so I always knew that that's what I was supposed to do. But I never made a commitment to it until I was in my 30s, which, looking back, is kind of funny because I knew the entire time that that's what I was supposed to do and that's what I really wanted to do. I would take odd jobs and this and that, and I had pretty much a writer's life. If you study the lives of a lot of writers, before they got successful, they ended up doing all sorts of other things.
I have to interrupt you here.
Go ahead.
We're getting to the end of our time, and we haven't even got to anybody's questions, and I want to say a couple of things, and I'm going to have to end the show. I wish we had 2 hours. I see a lot of what you're saying coming back through homeschools.
Mm-hmm.
And I see a big conflict between society and religion. If you're married to somebody, you're supposed to stay married to them forever, kind of thing. And a real short story. We had two people getting divorced in our county, and, you know, the courtroom has two doors, and they each went in one side, got their divorce things, and the man comes out one side of the double doors out of the courtroom, and his wife comes out the other double doors, and he takes a gun and shoots her six times, right in the face. And he went over to her, and he bent down with the officers that were trying to help her, and he said, if she ever comes to, tell her I love her. Now, that's pretty incredible. We need to do a show on religion and society and what's real and how people can talk about what's real. We have three dozen questions here that people have for you. So you got to come back because we got to do this again. And I'm going to read a short passage out of my very favorite book. Have you ever heard of The Velveteen Rabbit?
Uh-huh.
By Marjorie Williams. There's a passage in there that goes along with what we've been saying tonight. And Larry, it's such an honor to know you and to have you be part of my life and to have you on the show and to be able to create a space for you to share who you are with other people. I thank you from the bottom of my soul
for
being on the planet. I'm going to read this short thing. The Velveteen Rabbit by Marjorie Williams. What is real? Asked the rabbit one day when they were lying side by side near the nursery fender before Nana came to tidy the room. Does it mean having things that buzz inside you and a stick-out handle? Real isn't how you're made, said the skin horse. It's a thing that happens to you. When a child loves you for a long, long time, not just to play with, but really loves you, then you become real. Well, does it hurt? Asked the rabbit. Sometimes, said the skin horse, for he was always truthful. But when you're real, you don't mind being hurt. Well, does it happen all at once, like being wound up? He said, or just bit by bit. It doesn't happen all at once, said the skin horse. You become. It takes a long time. And that doesn't often happen to people who break easily, or have sharp edges, or have to be carefully kept. Generally, by the time you're real, most of your hair has been loved off. Your eyes drop out. You get loose in the joints. And you look very shabby. But those things don't matter at all. Because once you're real, you can't ever be ugly. Except to the people who don't understand. This is Sherry Edwards and Larry Trivieri for BBS Radio. Please join us next week when we'll bring you another provocative show.
Listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.